Today is October 4th, and we are so lucky to have Ambassador Freeman with us today. So
My
nice.
pleasure.
And let's get started, Ambassador, to talk about what's going on between Israel and Iran. And how do you find the current situation considering the latest attack, Iranian attack on Israel?
Well, I'd say a number of things. First, from Israel's point of view, eliminating Iran as a rival is a central purpose of Israeli foreign and defense policy, and it always has been. Israel has tended to treat movements, resistance movements like Hamas or in Lebanon, Hezbollah, as though they were somehow directed or created by Iran. They're not. They're independent. They have found common cause with Iran. But Israel, having seen the United States successfully destroy Iraq, which was the major society with the competence to attack Israel, is now trying to complete the process of achieving hegemony in the Middle East by enlisting the United States in a war with Iran. I think this is very clear, and I think there are a number of things that have not been adequately reported in the Western press or not reported at all. For example, Israel conducts assassinations of non-Israelis. I'm not aware that Iran does that. Iran has assassinated some Iranian dissidents in the past, but I don't know that it has ever assassinated an Israeli. Second, while Iran and Hezbollah, for that matter, both have limited their rocket attacks to military targets or intelligence targets, Israel is indiscriminate. So Iran is following the laws of war. Israel is not. I think this is important. And third, when Iran conducted its reprisal against Israel for its assassinations and its murder of Nasrallah in Lebanon, and his principal lieutenants too, something I want to come back to because I have a suspicion of how that happened. It's just a suspicion. But when they retaliated, they did so in a very brief, limited way with around 180, 200 missiles, which, by the way, did strike their targets, or at least struck areas near their targets. The West is portraying the Israeli ballistic defense system as having been very effective. But if you look at any video of the missiles arriving in Israeli airspace, you will see them striking the ground. So they were not intercepted. But anyway, after Iran launched this limited strike, it then announced that it was stopped. It would stop and would not do any more. And this was a very clear signal that while Israel wants a wider war and a war with Iran, Iran does not want a war with either Israel or the United States. So I think this is all an indication of who the belligerent is, who's the aggressor, and it's not Iran. It's not Hezbollah, for that matter. In fact, and here I will share my suspicion of why Nasrallah and his principal lieutenants were gathered in that bunker in one place, which I think traditionally they've been very careful not to do. The foreign minister of Lebanon, Bouhabib, said that there were active discussions of a ceasefire and peace going on between Hezbollah and Israel with the intermediary, with the U.S. as intermediary. But also Hezbollah accepted a peace offer, and it apparently communicated its acceptance to Walid Jumblatt, the Druze leader in Lebanon, and to the Lebanese government. So why were Nasrallah and his associates, his principal lieutenants, gathered? They were gathered to talk about whether to accept or not to accept the peace deal that had been proposed, supposedly, by Israel. And I don't think a peace deal would have been possible, in fact, because Israel would not give up its war in Gaza. And Hezbollah was very firm that that condition was necessary for it to stop its skirmishes along the border with northern Israel. However, I believe it is entirely possible that Israel trapped Nasrallah and his lieutenants by making an offer of peace, which would gather them in one place where they could be murdered. And they were murdered with 86 heavy bunker buster bombs supplied by the United States. And I note, finally, that there is a complete misreading of the importance of this in Washington. Admiral Kirby, who speaks with forked tongue, but speaks for the National Security Council, said he didn't imagine anybody was mourning the death of Nasrallah. And he could not be more wrong, and more, he could not make a more squalid moral statement than that. But he could not make a more ignorant statement, because Nasrallah has been mourned and protests have been launched pretty much throughout the Islamic world. And the fact that Admiral Kirby is unaware of this is an indication of how detached from reality American policy has become. So to sum up, Iran does not want a wider war. Israel does. Israel is in the process of generating that wider war by repeated provocations. Carefully planned its attack on Lebanon. And here, if you are going to attack someone, the first thing you do is disrupt their command, control, and communications. That's what the pager and walkie-talkie explosions did. And once you have confused them, you then try to decapitate them, which is what Israel did with the bunker buster bombs in Beirut. And Israel is now applying to Lebanon the same level of intensity of bombing that it applied to Gaza. And I believe its ambitions include annexing southern Lebanon. It has always had its eye on the Litani River as a source of water. And that area is predominantly Shia and dominated politically by Hezbollah. So they are ordering everybody there to leave, much as they did in Gaza. And they are bombing the place flat. There are some 4,000 buildings have been destroyed already. So this is not at all what is being portrayed in the mainstream media in the West. And I'm afraid that if judging by Admiral Kirby's statement, the White House is listening to the press and not to its own intelligence agencies, which probably have a very good idea of what is happening.
The president of Iran, Pezeshkian, was talking about in the aftermath of the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the United States was giving them false promises that they're going to bring some sort of ceasefire to Gaza. And it seems that in the eyes of the new government, they're having a lot of problems within Iran, because we have the other part of this community, these parties that are against the current foreign policy of Iran. And this new government is interested in having a better relationship with the United States. On the other hand, we have other parties that are totally against this. How do you see their position right now?
I think President Pezeshkian has been very clear from the beginning that he is a moderate voice within Iranian politics and wants to normalize relations with the West generally. Is prepared to renew discussions of Iran's nuclear program and to restore the JCPOA with the United States, which tore it up. And I think we collectively have put him in a very difficult position. In the end, he had no alternative but to lash out, although in a limited way, as he did a few days ago. And this is very unfortunate, because finally Iran has elected someone who would have been a reasonable person to talk to. But we're not talking to him, we're bombing him. And I think he's probably correct that he was getting signals from the Biden administration that were misleading, perhaps influenced by Israel, perhaps by people who actually are Israeli as well as American. Because let us remember that Amos Hochstein, who is the envoy for Lebanon from the United States, is an Israeli army veteran and dual national. So exactly who is working for whom in this context is never clear. So I suspect that President Pezeshkian must be very frustrated and quite angry about what was done.
And in your opinion right now, how do you see the way that Israel is trying to respond to Iran? Are they going to respond, and how, to what extent they're going to do this? And is that, can that be controlled by the United States?
Those are many questions wrapped in one. Israel will do what it thinks is most likely to provoke the United States into joining it. So I can't say exactly what that will be. It could be a false flag operation, which is something that Israel has done repeatedly throughout its history. Very early in the establishment of the state of Israel, Israel, for example, staged attacks on mosques and synagogues in Baghdad, in Cairo, with the intention of making it impossible for the Arab Jews to remain there and to force them to flee to Israel. And of course, they were then assimilated to the Western history of, which they didn't really know very much about, of the Holocaust, which is a central myth in Israeli politics. So I think that's the first answer. Israel will do something that is calculated to have the best chance of involving the United States. Second, Americans are not agreed at all about this, and there's quite a bit of evidence that the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies in Washington do not want it to allow Israel to do what it has been doing, which is drawing the United States into a wider war in the Middle East. I think they are very aware that one of the main effects of Israeli policy and actions has been to thoroughly discredit the United States and deprive us of influence. There's an article in Foreign Affairs magazine by someone calling for a renewal of shuttle diplomacy. But there is no basis for shuttle diplomacy. There is no clear objective that could be shared with anyone for shuttle diplomacy. And I think it's a miracle that so far the so-called Abraham Accords have not been torn up by Bahrain, by the UAE. I noticed that Bahrain has suspended them, basically. I don't know how much longer they will last. So anyway, the U.S. really doesn't have the contacts. We can't talk to Iran. We can't talk to Russia, which is now a factor again. After all, the Russians defended Syria against ballistic attack from Israel, which is quite an important moment. And they also counseled their Russians in Israel to leave, which is something new. And finally, just to illustrate this point, there was just a meeting in Doha, in Qatar, between the Gulf Cooperation Council members and Iran. At that meeting, the GCC declared its neutrality between Israel and Iran. So the American and Israeli effort to use opposition to Iran to bring Israel into a normal relationship with Saudi Arabia and other Arabs has failed. It's gone. It's finished. And so there's no basis for shuttle diplomacy. And finally, I think what Israel has been doing has been conducting attacks on its neighbors with the hope that they would retaliate and that the United States would then join them in another round of retaliation. That's been the pattern to date. And unfortunately, it appears to have support among some in the United States. On the other hand, 70% of Americans do not want American weapons going to Israel anymore. And the figure is much higher when you get to the youth. So we have, in Iran, as you suggested, there are disconnects between hardliners, anti-Western elements, maybe religiously conservative people, and more secular people, and more people more interested in relations with the outside world. And in Washington, there is a complete disconnect between popular opinion and the political elite. The political elite is in the pocket of Israel. The public at large is no longer in the pocket of Israel. So this is having widespread effects, and it's not just destroying American influence in the Middle East, it is destroying it more widely in the Islamic world and beyond it. So it has discredited us in the eyes of, for example, of your president, Lula, in Brasilia, and others in South America. President of Colombia, for example, President of Chile. I think this is the only one left is Milei in Argentina, who is a rather odd person anyway. I know, by the way, that he's apparently repented of his anti-communist stance toward China and is going off to Beijing on bended knee with his hand out for something. So he's not as unrealistic as he appears.
Yeah. And here is Anthony Blinken. The leaked document showed that he was not honest with the Congress and the way that he was reporting on the conflict in Gaza. And it seems that in order to help Israel, he decided not to be honest with the Congress of the United States in reporting what's going on. And in your opinion, this comes from his point of view, or it comes from the Biden administration? Because at the end of the day, there has to be somebody to check on what he's talking about.
Well, I think Mr. Blinken gave the reason for this apparent deception of the Congress when he arrived after October 7th in Israel and announced that he was there as a Jew and as a descendant of a Holocaust survivor. He did not say he was there as the American Secretary of State or on behalf of the American people. So very clearly his sympathies are entirely with Israel and the Israelis. And this may account for his complete failure as a diplomat who put a lot of apparent energy into obtaining a hostage release, although not addressing the root causes of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which he assiduously avoided. In any event, I don't think he was, whatever his personal beliefs may be, if they are as he's declared them, I think he was representing Joe Biden and the White House, because they have been very consistently biased toward Israel and indifferent to the death of Palestinians. And the whole discussion that Mr. Blinken conducted was not about ending the genocide, but about releasing the hostages for a limited period of ceasefire, following which Israel would resume the genocide. So whatever this was, it was not a skeptical attitude toward Israel, not a support of Palestinian rights, but a service to Israeli foreign policy. So I think when history is written, this will be a period in which he will not look good.
When we look at Israel right now, the way that they're trying to make troubles with the Palestinians right now, with Lebanese, with Syria, yeah, with Yemen, and right now with Iran, I think they're getting to the maximum capacity that to bring the United States into the conflict. The only thing to puzzle
They're trying very hard.
The only piece of puzzle missing in this calculation would be Donald Trump in office to go.
Well, the only piece missing is Iran, which has been very restrained in its response. And indeed, Pezeshkian is under great criticism in Iran for having been as restrained as he has been. One can certainly understand the desire of Israelis for vengeance, to lash out, to hurt those whom they believe hurt them. And Israel has a long history of considering itself to be the victim of history and the victim of its neighbors. I mean, the neighbors, I think, see it the opposite way, that Israel was essentially dumped on them by British colonialism and then supported by American neocolonialism, and has never made peace really with any of its neighbors. The peace with Egypt was brokered by the United States, but it took place at the initiative of Egypt. It was Sadat who went to Jerusalem to make peace. It was Jimmy Carter, not Menachem Begin, who pushed for peace. And the same is true, I think, of the Jordanian peace. It is a cold peace. It was arranged by the United States. It was a product of realpolitik. There is no warmth to the relationship, quite the contrary. And in fact, King of Jordan is in some difficulty because of the fact that he has not actively opposed Israel. And in fact, he apparently participated in the defense of Israel in this latest Iranian attack, because the missiles, in this case, hypersonic missiles, which don't follow a ballistic track, came into Jordanian airspace. So he tried to shoot them down. I don't know if he succeeded at all. But anyway, if you look at the region, you find that the Israel's neighbors regard it as a sort of cancer that they wish could be cut out. Who supports Israel? The perpetrators of the Holocaust in Europe, who have a guilty conscience, notably the Germans, but not just the Germans. And the United States, which is home to the largest Jewish population in the world, even larger than Israel. And where, Judaism is highly respected in the United States, and very appropriately. It's a very humane, ancient religion with much wisdom. But I don't think Israelis have anything to do with that religion at this point, except the forms. And it's my contention that Judaism went to Israel to die, and it has died there. What we have is Jewish nationalism, Israeli nationalism, which thoughtful members of the Jewish faith regard as the equivalent of the golden calf in the Bible, worshiping an idolatrous form of worship directed at the Israeli state and its flag rather than at God. I think we have to be very careful. American Jews, Brazilian Jews, other Jews in the outside Israel are, for the most part, very decent people who are deeply disturbed by what Israel is doing. And they should not be treated as though they were Israelis. But Israelis have become something else. I think Israel, you saw the walkout on Netanyahu in the General Assembly of the UN. And Israel's obviously a pariah state. Now, nobody wants to be associated with it except the United States and a few others. And I think internationally it is reviled as a quintessentially evil actor in international affairs, amoral, murderous. This can't be good for Israel in the longer run. I think Mr. Netanyahu, as I've said before, will bear a lot of responsibility for the destruction of Israel that is in progress. the destruction of its economy, the emigration of many of its best people, the battle damage that is occurring, the fear that is generating, the odious reputation of Israel internationally, the splitting of Americans and others who were always very supportive of Israel into people who are disgusted by it and those who are still hardline supporters. And all of this risks the reestablishment of anti-Semitism. It never really went away, but it has been an insignificant factor, except in the minds of those who wish to perceive it. There's no argument in the United States, for example. Jews are among the most privileged, wealthy, best educated people among all Americans and greatly respected. Where's the evidence of anti-Semitism? Sure, there may be some. It's also anti-Black, anti-White, anti-Asian, anti-this, that, and the other. It somehow doesn't take on the significance assigned to anti-Semitism because the world's Jews were traumatized, understandably, by the fact that Europeans tried to exterminate them. And they are now trying to exterminate the Palestinians. And the world doesn't approve of that any more than we approved of the attempt to commit genocide on European Jews.
Yeah. There are two concepts, Ambassador, right now. On one side, yesterday I talked with Michael Hudson and earlier with Gilbert Doctorow, and he's a Russian analyst.
Yes, and, I know him.
Yeah. And both of them, and I know, if I'm not mistaken, Noam Chomsky has the same kind of idea that the United States is running the show in Israel. And they're talking about that behind what Israel is doing is the United States. And this is one side of this story. The other part would be John Mearsheimer and other analysts that, like Larry Johnson, that regularly I'm talking with him on this podcast. He says that no, it's Israel that is running the show, even in the United States. What's your take? You know the system. You work with this system. What's the real background of this question?
I'm with Mearsheimer and Johnson on this, emphatically. And my own experience bears that out. Not only was I pilloried, mugged, if you will, by the Israel lobby when I was named to be the chairman of the National Intelligence Council. But I will recall a hearing which was on the subject of the South African nuclear program at a time when I was the senior officer dealing with Africa and testifying in the House Intelligence Committee. Steve Solars, a really brilliant and Jewish congressman from New York, who was a good friend of mine, suddenly started in on the South African nuclear program, and immediately his handler from the Israel lobby came up and whispered in his ear, "You're going to get us, this is going to lead to a discussion of the Israeli nuclear program." And he said, "Oh, I want to change the subject." So what is the evidence? The evidence is Israel's nuclear program began with the theft of uranium from Pennsylvania, with a denial, repeated denial to John F. Kennedy and later to Lyndon Johnson by Shimon Peres that there was any nuclear bomb program, by the defiance of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the entire regime. But not just that. No official can be appointed to a position in the U.S. government who is mildly critical of Israel. You can be critical of the United States in Israel. You can be critical of Israel in Israel. You cannot be critical of Israel in the United States. Israel exacts tribute from the United States in the form of an annual transfer of wealth. And it's not just the government. There are laws that make Israel exempt from the usual rule. You know, if I wanted to give a charitable contribution to the Nima Al-Khorshid Foundation in southern Brazil, I could not take a tax deduction for that. But if you were an Israeli foundation, I could. So there are privileges. We have seen recently that those who choose to protest Israeli policy are severely punished by university administrators, and who are being driven to that by the wealthy Jewish donors who object to those protests. So I would say that it's frankly nonsense to imagine that somehow or other the United States is directing Israel. The United States has become an instrument of Israeli foreign and defense policy. How many vetoes have we issued in the UN Security Council to protect Israel from the consequences of its misdeeds or to apply international law to it? This is a one-sided relationship. I have great respect for Gilbert Doctorow on Russian matters, but I think on this he's completely wrong.
Yeah. And when it comes, Ambassador, to the conflict in Israel and between Israel and Palestinians, here is the question. The main question is what the United States would do in order to bring some sort of sanity to the conflict. And here is Matt Miller talking about this.
The second question is, the Secretary and you often say that Israel has the right to defend itself, but how it does it, it matters. So this morning, there were 6 first responders were killed in Lebanon, civilians. In Gaza, it's over 40,000, 70% are women and children. In Lebanon, is 1 million people are homeless. So when he says how it matters, if there's no consequences in Israel, doesn't his word carry no weight? Does it mean that is really a statement for public consumption?
No, absolutely not.
Right.
Absolutely not. Look, wars have horrific consequences. They always have. They always will. And these wars have had horrific consequences for the people of Gaza and now for the people of Lebanon. It is why the U.S. has worked so hard to try to reach a diplomatic resolution to the conflict in Lebanon. And what you saw going back months is Hezbollah refusing to stop its attacks on civilian targets inside Israel. It's why we've tried to reach a ceasefire agreement in Gaza that would ultimately lead to the guns being silenced, hostages coming home, humanitarian assistance surging in. We will continue to pursue both of those things. But in each of these cases, it is just a little more complicated than the question concedes. It is more complicated when you...
So he was, before he became the entirely incredible, odious spokesman for the Department of State, every time he opens his mouth, he costs us credibility internationally. You saw an example of that in that clip. First of all, Hezbollah has not been attacking civilian targets. Second, he never mentioned Gaza and the genocide there. The condition for a ceasefire, which Hezbollah said it would immediately implement, was Israel's halt in the genocide. He excuses Israel, and he was a spokesman for Israel on Fox News before he came into the government. He at least is consistent in his equivocations and prevarications and his evasions of questions. But this kind of thing, which is replicated at the National Security Council by Admiral Kirby, basically destroys American credibility because it is demonstrably false. Israel pays no attention to killing civilians. It doesn't care. And a final point, the questioner asked about the 40,000 dead in Gaza. The Lancet says it's closer to 200,000. A group of American doctors who served in Gaza say that it's close to 120,000. The 40,000 figure is a gross misstatement of the level of the damage and death that Israel has wrought. Now, and the last point is, we were working so hard for a ceasefire. Really? Then how come 86 bunker buster bombs were available from the United States to drop on Nasrallah and his lieutenants? How come the flow of weapons didn't halt? There was one faltering suspension for a short time of weapons, certain weapons deliveries. We have leverage. We have not used it. So the only reasonable conclusion that people can draw is that the administration is entirely hypocritical, just as hypocritical as Matthew Miller just was. Says one thing, does another. And this is inexplicable in the terms that he tried to explain it. It's not that the subject is complicated. It isn't that complicated. People are dying. You want to stop that? We have the ability to do that. Are we doing that? No, we're not. We're talking out of one side of our mouth while we murder people and don't do anything about it.
Do you find any, how about the timing of these activities on the part of Israelis, the way they're doing this right now with this incursion in Lebanon? Does it have anything to do with what's going on in the United States?
Well, I think it may, but I think that's peripheral, frankly. Netanyahu saw a major opportunity on October 7th to complete the process of removing the Palestinians from Palestine. This has always been the Zionist objective, a land without people for Jews to settle, and a state in which Jewish supremacy rules. This was the basic premise of Zionism, that Jews would be persecuted or have difficulty unless they had an absolute majority in their own state. And others, Palestinians, were relegated to a relatively small, manageable minority. Now, in Israel proper, that minority is about 20%. I don't know whether 20% of people in Gaza are going to be left at the end of this, or 20% of the people in southern Lebanon, or 20% of the people on the West Bank, where there are pogroms, military-assisted evictions, and murders going on as we speak. So Netanyahu saw an opportunity to do two things. One was to produce the Palestinian-free Palestine that has always been the objective of Zionism. And the other was to establish regional supremacy militarily. As I mentioned earlier, if he, the United States, eliminated Iraq as a formidable enemy, we brokered peace with Egypt. We tried to do the same with Syria, but didn't. We brokered peace with Jordan. We have counseled the Lebanese to be meek and not to oppose Israel. And we have tried to broker relations between Israel and the Gulf Arab states. Now the only thing left is Iran. And Netanyahu's objective is to use the United States, if not to destroy Iran, because that's probably impossible. 2,500 years of Persian history suggest it is impossible, but to maim Iran, to weaken it so much that it no longer is able to challenge Israeli rule in West Asia. So he knows what he's doing. And I think you add to all of this, you add his narcissistic approach to his own future. He knows if he's out of the prime ministership, if there's no war, he will be out on the street. And if he's on the street, he will be arrested and he will spend time in jail for corruption. So he has every incentive to press on with the effort to brew up a wider war. And that's what he's going to do. And here's the final point. A major damage to the credibility of the United States in that whatever we ask Netanyahu to do publicly, he does not follow that advice. He has humiliated Biden, who looks like an utter weakling, not only to foreigners, but to many Americans. Whatever your view of this is, he has been utterly ineffectual, as has his Secretary of State, as has his National Security Advisor. Mr. Biden is leaving a legacy which is not admirable. A war in Ukraine that Ukraine is losing, a million people dead in Ukraine, and and adjacent areas of Russia, maybe more, hundreds of thousands of dead in West Asia, a debacle in terms of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Where is the success? A brewing war with China, is that a success? A North Korean nuclear arsenal that grows day by day to pose a threat to the United States with no diplomacy whatsoever directed at addressing this. A purely militaristic policy in which diplomacy is all show and tell for domestic audiences and accomplishes nothing. This is not a legacy to be proud of. And it is having an effect in our election. And you can be sure Mr. Netanyahu has his eye on that election. One of the things that a wider war in the Middle East might do is thoroughly discredit Kamala Harris as a member of the Biden administration and push the election toward Mr. Trump. We have seen how manipulable Mr. Trump is. You know, he moved the American embassy illegally to Jerusalem. He illegally acknowledged the Israeli attempted annexation of the Golan Heights. He did nothing to protect the Palestinians. And on the campaign trail, he uses the word Palestinian as some kind of insult, disrespectfully. So you think Mr. Netanyahu would not like Mr. Trump back? Of course he would. And recall his several addresses to Congress in which he was wholly supportive of the Trump wing of the Republican Party against the wishes of the Democratic Party, with no effective opposition, by the way, from the Biden administration, which also looked weak and was humiliated. So yes, US election November 5th is a factor in all this. That is a month from today, and basically. And so that figures. But the more fundamental issue is Zionist strategy seems to have a chance finally to empty Palestine of Palestinians and to establish Israeli hegemony in West Asia. That is the main objective.
Yeah. And Ambassador, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, recently there is an article written by the former British Secretary of State for Defense, Ben Wallace, who has a military background. He says that we have to follow the way that Netanyahu is behaving in the Middle East in order to win the conflict in Ukraine. Do you understand in his eyes what Netanyahu is doing that Ukraine is capable of doing it in against Russia?
I think this is a general philosophical argument for a purely military approach to foreign policy. It's very clear that he may understand defense policy, having been the Minister of Defense, but it is equally clear that he has no understanding of statesmanship and the advantages of diplomatic efforts to reduce threats or eliminate them, as opposed to military confrontations aimed at doing that. And your point, however, Ukraine does not have the capability to do anything like what Israel has done. It is not armed to the same extent. It is not as ferocious. It is defending its own territory, not for the most part attacking Russia. It has been used as a tool, and Gilbert Doctorow is right about this. It has been used as a tool to, quote, weaken and isolate Russia, which has not succeeded, but it does not have any capability comparable to that of Israel. And how well is Israel doing? You know, is this benefiting Israel? It's losing its population. Its economy is in tatters. Its soldiers are exhausted. Its international reputation is now entirely negative. Its support in the West is jeopardized. So Ukraine should do the same thing? No. That would be unbelievably foolish, even if Ukraine had the ability to do it, which it doesn't.
And right now, in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, do you think that the So far, we haven't heard from Anthony Blinken in the aftermath of that meeting between Biden and Starmer, in which they were talking about the long-range missiles to Ukraine. Do you think that Pentagon is still in charge of what's going on in Ukraine?
I don't know that they're in charge. It's very clear that they and the intelligence community do not favor long-range strikes into Russia, because they correctly perceive that all this will do is stimulate Russia to make even more ferocious attacks on Ukraine, or at the worst, to strike at the backup bases for these Ukrainian operations in neighboring countries like Poland and Romania. So this would widen the risks, widening the war. And they know very well we are not prepared for a major war with the Russians. We can't even produce the munitions for Ukraine. If you imagine a wider war, in which I suspect China would be aligned with Russia. China's been very careful. It is non-aligned. It has not recognized the annexation of Crimea. It has not recognized the annexation of Donetsk or Lugansk or Zaporizhia or anywhere. It is not in favor of a wider war. It is trying to make peace. So this business that it's helping Russia is an extrapolation from the foolish phrase, you're either with us or against us. If you're not with us, you must be against us. Nonsense. India is not against us, but it has exactly the same posture as China, as does most of the world. So I think Mr. Wallace is way off base here.
Yeah. Recently, we had a talk, an interview between two Russian pranksters who were pretending to be Poroshenko with Mike Pompeo, in which he was addressing he was pointing out the way that he would
do. I think he was
separate China from Russia. The way that he was describing it was so amazing that it was so simple, but I'm afraid that would be the case when it comes to the Trump administration if he wins 2024 presidential election. Let me play it out for you to see what he said in there.
You can't let them believe that they get to this is really a China issue for me. We need to pull the Russians back into a European model, not an Asian model.
Mm. But for you, does it mean that Russia is going far away from West if they're trying to go to China's?
We need to prevent it from happening.
Really? So how we can manage it?
If this war stopped, and you begin to bring Russia back in and convince them that they're in a better place with us than them. There's nothing fancy about it.
It's simple. It's just a game in his mind. It doesn't seem he has any sort of strategy in his back.
He's obsessed with China. So China is the root of all evil. And the answer to China, obviously, is to detach its a partner from it. So this is a sort of a simple-minded reversal of what Nixon and Kissinger did with China. You know, China and the Soviet Union had broken up. China was fighting on the border with the Soviet Union. And so we enlisted this former Soviet partner, China, in support of our policy of containing the Soviet Union. But this is utter nonsense in the current context, especially in as much as anti-Russian sentiment is in the United States, irrational as it may be, is at least as deep as anti-China sentiment. I mean, the only element that's missing is racism, because the Russians are European in appearance, most of them, not all, and the Chinese are not. So this is comic, really, as the pranksters intended. You know, I thought you were talking to, they also did a number on Radislav Sikorsky, and forced him to admit what everybody should know, namely that Ukraine is not qualified to join the European Union. It's not a democracy. It's very corrupt. It has border problems. It is not treating its minorities, Russian, Hungarian, Romanian, or whatever, properly. It's totally unqualified, and it would take at least a decade of reform for Ukraine to meet the standards of the EU. You know, I mean, Turkey tried and failed because basically Europeans are prejudiced against Islam. And the French in particular have a concept of Europe as Christendom. You know, it's really rather like the Zionist concept of Israel. You could have a small Islamic or what Jewish or whatever minority, but the overwhelming majority have to be Christian. So they are against the Turks. The Kurds actually made a real effort over 300 years, very intensely in the last 50, to become European. So did the Russians. That's over. Turkey's now looking to Iran, to Iraq, to Syria, to Central Asia, to Russia, to China, to Africa. And Russia's reoriented toward India and China and Africa as well, and the Middle East. So I think what is really significant, and we just passed over it in the context of the current crisis in the Middle East, is that the Russians are becoming more engaged. They have, you know, apparently provided a missile defense to Iran, an upgraded missile defense. They've just used a missile defense in Syria, probably because the Israelis foolishly were attacking areas close to their naval base in Syria, but I don't know. Originally, I was told they were defending Lebanon, but I don't believe they are yet. They may come to do that. So this is taking on some elements of Russian-American rivalry to parallel the situation in the Cold War, when the U.S. and the Soviet Union several times were provoked by Israeli attacks on their neighbors, or counterattacks in the case of the 73 Yom Kippur Ramadan War, several times came very close to a nuclear exchange. Now, Israel has, and its activities have global implications, as we are seeing. They have implications for U.S.-Russian relations. So far, the Chinese have sensibly sat this one out, but how long can they do that? You know, they have clearly supported the Palestinian side for the first time, really, rather than being even-handed. So this is Israel's actions are having both short-term and long-term effects, and they're not favorable to Israel, in my view.
Yeah. Before wrapping up this session, I want to talk about the European Union and countries in Europe. Right now in Germany, we have protests against the policy of Germany toward Ukraine. And recently, Macron was talking about the United States and their policy and how do they see the world, their priority, what would be the priority of the United States. And it seems that he's so afraid of Donald Trump. They're so afraid of Donald Trump if he wins in 2024. Here is what he said.
I think we have to be lucid on our situation. Europe is no more the top priority of the US. The US top priority is US, which is normal and fair. The second top priority is China. And for the rest, it depends on the moment. They are a super loyal and reliable partner on Ukraine. Will it last? I don't know. But let's be clear, at the same time, in Afghanistan, we didn't have the call before. And in the AUKUS deal in Australia, I didn't have the call before. But it's not a reproach. I try to be lucid. The EU is not the priority of the US. And this is why part of the wake-up call period of time we are living, and part of what we have to completely reshape, is our defense and security strategy. We are part of NATO, no discussion. We are a strong ally of the US, no discussion. But we have to de-risk our model from the US agenda.
I don't know if the quality of sound, the audio was that good to understand.
A little hard to understand, but I think he's being consistent with the French Gaullist tradition, the desire to lead Europe on an independent path while relying still on the alliance with the United States. So he's not repudiating the transatlantic relationship, but he's arguing for a separate role within it, led, of course, by his own country, by France, and by him. The Germans are a somewhat different matter. They are disturbed by the war and its economic and other effects. It has become very unpopular, particularly with the German right, which is gaining leverage in the elections in the German lender, the states. I think there are also German nationalists who've really had enough of the post-war American occupation of their country and would like to see Germany take a leading role within Europe, not precisely the one that France wants, but to take a more independent view and to take a more diplomatic than military view of developments in Ukraine. And finally, of course, Mr. Macron is very concerned, as you suggested, about the election of Donald Trump and whether he would simply walk away from Ukraine, having the United States having sponsored the death of a million or more people connected with the Ukraine war, you know, could just walk away from it. I mean, after all, we walked away from Vietnam, did we not? You know, we have a history. We walked away from Afghanistan. So much for the rights of women in Afghanistan. So much for NATO operations in Afghanistan. So I think he's saying that while he hopes the United States is reliable, he can't be sure. And that is not an unreasonable doubt on his part. So the European Union remains divided internally. It is not. It has not agreed on a course of action. Many Europeans are, however, a bit tired of policies made in Washington that don't seem to work, or that seem to produce, in the case of Germany, their impoverishment as a result of the loss of cheap Russian energy.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always, talking with you and learning from you.
Well, thank you, Nima, and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.